Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and this is the Sunday Roundup. Security has dominated the agenda today in the wake of Monday's appalling terrorist attack in Manchester. Home Secretary Amber Rudd told Andrew Marr that the operation by the security services is still ongoing.
You've downgraded the threat level 1 point.
Yes.
And we hear that a large part of the group around this terrorist have been apprehended and taken. Does that mean that some of the group are still out there?
Potentially. I mean, it's an ongoing operation. There are 11 people in custody. The operation is still at full tilt in a way. And so until the operation is complete, we can't be entirely sure that it's closed.
Now, clearly, as you said, the security services do a great job and all the rest of it. Nonetheless, there are questions that must be asked. Can I ask you how many times the security services were tipped off about Salman Abedi before he attacked?
Well, it's not for me to be drawn in on what the intelligence services did or didn't know, particularly at this stage, Andrew.
Well, the trouble is we do know some stuff about this.
We do, but the fact is this is an ongoing operation. The fact that you've already asked me are there other people that are going to be potentially pursued, that is because of the strong relationship between the intelligence services and the counter-terrorism policing. Of course, people will want to look afterwards to see whether there are signals that could have been learnt, how could we do this better? But can I also point out that since 2013, they have foiled 18 separate plots. They do a good job. We're not frightened, though, of learning lessons and improving.
I don't want in any way to diminish what they do. Nevertheless, what we do know is that Salman Abedi was identified as a dangerous man by friends and family, his community, doing exactly what we asked them to do. They phoned the terror hotline 5 years ago and then again last year. We know that the imam in his local mosque used the prevent strategy again to get in touch and say this guy is out of control, he's dangerous, and apparently nothing happened. Can I ask you directly, was Salman Abedi on a surveillance list?
I don't know those details that you've just said out to me because the intelligence services are still collecting information about him and about the people around him. But I wouldn't rush to conclusions, as you seem to be, that they've somehow missed something.
I'm simply saying that people had phoned the terror hotline, as they're told to
do. As they should do. And this, you know, the reason we've put in place the terror hotline, the reason we've put in place the prevent strategy is because we recognise the scale of the problem. What this reminds us, if we needed reminding, is the scale of the problem that we have. The enemy that we have, Daesh, that is trying to weaponize the young people in our society. We have put in place measures to make sure we can protect us, but we have been at severe, as I said, for a number of years, which is a threat. An attack is highly likely. But we will look to see what else we can do, which is why the Prime Minister has announced, actually in our manifesto before this event, that there would be a commission for extremism to see what else we can do to root out extremism, to put legislation in place if we need to make sure we take action to stop extremism taking root in our society.
However, when quizzed by Jo Coburn on the Sunday Politics, Security Minister Ben Wallace told her that the government was not planning on putting extra resources into MI5.
I mean, the government says there are up to 23,000 potential terrorist attackers in this country. 3,000 of those considered to pose a serious threat and are under investigation or being monitored in 500 separate operations. 20,000 others are considered as residual risk. That's pretty disturbing. These are big numbers.
They are big numbers. And I think, you know, what the tragedy of Manchester shows us is that this is not about failure. This is about the scale of the challenge we face. And it's why it's absolutely important that alongside people is powers.
Right. Should you double the size of MI5, for example, which has been called...
We have increased year on year in real terms, not only the money, but also the numbers of people in MI5. We've now... It's actually 2,000 that we have committed to increase... to before the attack, not just Jeremy Corbyn's response to this attack, before our manifesto, we have recruited, we've increased the whole of government spending on counter-terrorism from £11.7 billion in 2010 up
sure.
to,
but
in 2015,
you,
up to £15.7 billion.
Would you do something radical, like double the size of MI5 and expand the number of intelligence
there, please,
in my
discussions with the Director-General of MI5 and his deputies and all the other people I meet, I ask them on a regular basis if they have the resource that they are happy with. And their answer comes back time and time again, yes,
all right,
we
let's have a look.
Meanwhile, ITV's Robert Peston queried Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn over his track record of continually voting against anti-terror legislation, which he claimed that Corbyn had done on at least 17 different occasions.
People have got a choice on June the 8th, and the choice will partly be about who they think is going to keep them safest.
OK, on your point about anti-terror laws, yes, I have been assiduous in my scrutiny of anti-terror
and
laws
voting against
in Parliament. And voting against, in common with David Davis, on occasions Theresa May and others, on the basis that anti-terror laws are important, but they must be subject to judicial oversight. My concern was always we were going down the road of executive orders, executive detention and executive control. Everything must be subject to a judicial process. Why did I form this opinion? Because I represent a constituency that had, still has, a large Irish population, many of whom were detained under the Prevention of Terrorism Act in the 1970s, again without judicial oversight. It was the attempted criminalisation of large numbers of young people, which of course drives them in a very bad direction. So my point on the anti-terror laws was not that you don't need an effective anti-terror strategy. You must have an independent judicial oversight of what goes on.
But you have been vocal in your opposition to the monitoring of suspected terrorists. Was that a mistake?
I've been vocal in my opposition to executive control orders that are not subject to judicial oversight.
Now, on TPIM notices, which actually, you know, the former terrorist czar, Alex Carlisle, says don't go far enough in providing us with restrictions on the behaviour of suspected terrorists, you said that they were a very, very serious attack on our liberty and it's important that we oppose them.
Yes, because of the question of judicial oversight. That was the point. I do support and work with the police and our security services on intelligence-led actions. And what this government has
not... But they would argue, that if they have to act swiftly, there are times when judicial oversight is not appropriate.
Well, they can intervene on the basis of suspicion at any time of a criminal intent taking place. They can do that anyway. That's what the police are for.
But so to be absolutely clear, were you to become Prime Minister, you would, if necessary, enact more restrictive laws on, to monitor, restrict the activities of potential terrorists. Because let's be clear, I mean, MI5 says there are, as you know, at least 3,000 individuals in this country who are a direct threat to our security, and possibly 23,000 in total who could be a great threat to the security and lives of our people.
Yes, and those people are presumably, I hope, being monitored on an intelligence-led basis. But it seems that the cuts in police numbers have led to some very dangerous situations emerging. It's also a question of a community response as well, so that where an imam, for example, alerts the police that he's very concerned about somebody, I would hope they would act. And I hope they would have the resources to act as well.
Corbyn did manage to find some support in the shape of Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon. Speaking to Sky's Sophie Ridge, Sturgeon defended the Labour leader against the accusation that he thought UK foreign policy was to blame for the Manchester attack.
Now, it feels like we should start off with the horrific terror attack that we saw in Manchester. 22 people dead, including a young Scottish schoolgirl. Do you think Jeremy Corbyn was right to link it to UK foreign policy in places like Libya and Iraq?
Well, firstly, all of our thoughts remain with the victims of the Manchester attack. It was absolutely horrific and atrocious. And after the dreadful week we've had, it's actually lovely to be sitting here with the sound of children playing behind us. You know, let me say two things about the Jeremy Corbyn speech. Firstly, nobody, and I don't believe Jeremy Corbyn was saying that there is anybody other than the terrorists to blame for acts of terrorism. You know, terrorists will always look for reasons to justify their actions, but there is no justification, there's no excuse, there's nobody else to blame. The person responsible for the attack in Manchester was the man who blew himself and, unfortunately, others up on Monday night. But the second point I would make is that I think we must be free, particularly in a general election campaign, to have honest debates about foreign policy and to have honest debates about security and how we keep the population of the country safe. And I think we should be able to do that without anybody suggesting that anybody that criticises UK foreign policy, and I've got many criticisms of UK foreign policy, is in any way, shape or form trying to justify the horrific and dreadful actions of terrorists.
So with that in mind, do you agree then that there are links between what's happened in the past with UK foreign policy and terrorist attacks that we're seeing now?
Let me repeat, it's not an excuse, it's not a justification, but you know, I remember when the former head of MI5 herself said that the war in Iraq had led to greater radicalisation in the UK and had raised different issues about different threats and different issues in terms of keeping the country safe. So I think in any healthy democracy, and remember terrorists are trying to undermine our democracy, we've got to protect our ability in a healthy democracy to have these debates. I've been a long critic of the war in Iraq. I don't think it helped the situation in Iraq and it had implications at home. I've been a critic of the air campaign in Syria, not because I question the motivations of people wanting to find a solution in Syria, but I question the efficacy of a campaign from the air. We must be able to have those debates.
So you agree with Jeremy Corbyn then that it's made us less safe and it's made terrorist attacks more likely?
Well, I think there are issues about foreign policy and the implications and the implications for radicalisation here, but where I would disagree with anybody, and to be, I'm not here to advocate for Jeremy Corbyn, but where I think it is probably slightly unfair is to say that he was somehow saying that that meant, I mean, I heard Theresa May saying that what Jeremy Corbyn was saying, that we only had ourselves to blame for what happened in Manchester. I don't think that's what he was saying. I don't think it is what any right-thinking person would say. But we must have the ability to have honest debates.
And finally, Diane Abbott has raised a few eyebrows and more when she linked her hairstyle to her politics. Confronted by Andrew Marr about remarks she had made in defence of the IRA, Abbott highlighted how times and fashions can change.
But to know how to go forward, we have to look behind and look at people's records, which is why I've been talking about you. Mm. Now, Jeremy Corbyn got into some trouble with Andrew Neil in his interview where he said he had not met the IRA, and he was then photographed lots of people from the IRA during the course of his career. You yourself said that it would be a defeat for the British state, would be a great liberation, a great move forward at that period of time. Do you regret your support for the IRA right back in the 80s?
That particular quote you're referring to comes from a now defunct left newspaper, and it had, as well as this,
but you said it, didn't you?
No, but what I'm saying to you is this. It was 34 years ago. I had a rather splendid afro at the time. I don't have the same hairstyle. And I don't have the same views. It is 34 years on. The hairstyle has gone and some of the views have gone.
So you no longer you regret the fact of what you said then about the IRA?
The hairstyle has gone, the views have gone. We've all moved on in 34 years, haven't you, Andrew?
We've all moved on. I'm just wondering, do you regret what you said about the IRA at the height of the bombing?
What specifically do you want me to regret?
I can read the quote for you and find it here. Basically, what you said was that a defeat of the IRA would be devastating for the British people, and it was a defeat for the British state was a good thing, you said, at the time when the IRA was attacking the British state. And you said that the reason for the violence was entirely caused by the British presence in Northern Ireland. I'm saying, do you think those statements now are wrong?
It was 34 years ago. I've moved on.
You've moved on. All right.
That's all for this week. I'm Isabel Hardman, and this podcast was produced by Matthew Taylor. Don't forget to subscribe to the Coffeehouse Shots podcast on the iTunes store, and you can receive a special election offer of 6 issues of The Spectator for £6 at spectator.co.uk/election offer.